That's the Mingus Big Band, formed to carry out the work of the great composer, bandleader, and bassist with his famous composition, Haitian Fight Song. It's a classic. It's from their 1999 album, Blues and Politics, in honor of Charlie Mingus's body of work. Mingus died in 1979 at the age of 56. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. In the second half of the program today, we will return to the discussion we started yesterday about what are the options and what is the reckoning that we are prepared to do now ahead of the outcome that we know we can expect of this race. But first, we go to our dear friend and a colleague and correspondent, if you will, on Haiti Matters Haitian, Kim Ives, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the English language division of Haiti Liberté, an international community, who will be telling us about a scathing report by UN Special Rapporteur Philip Alston that was released yesterday condemning the United Nations for denying responsibility for a cholera epidemic that has ravaged Haiti since 2010, and blames the Security Council and the Obama administration in particular for shielding the United Nations from blame. Kim, great to have you as always.
Thank you, Eutrice. Always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Well, this was a devastating report. It seemed to not get as much coverage as it ought to have, because this is the final report. This is the second and final report filed by Philip Alston, who is a special rapporteur for the UN on Haiti, and well, not just Haiti, but generally on poverty and issues related. And he also had filed a preliminary report some time ago. This report basically being the big note on this question. What did the report say?
Well, the essence of the report is to say that the UN's position on its introduction of cholera into Haiti, of which it's been a target of several lawsuits, the most well-known and the first being brought by the Bureau of International Lawyers and the IJDH, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, since 2011, has been to stonewall and essentially say, no, we have immunity. There's nothing you can do to prosecute us for introducing cholera into Haiti, which has now claimed 10,000 lives, about a million people sickened. These are conservative estimates. Philip Alston essentially said, this is morally, quote, this is his quote, morally unconscionable, legally indefensible, and politically self-defeating. He said it's an unsustainable policy, which does, again, quote-unquote, a huge disservice to the UN. And here is the UN posturing as the great moral judge and compass of humanity, and yet it's engaging in this wanton disregard and violation, crime, essentially, against the Haitian people. So now the UN has finally, as of 2 days ago, said, okay, we're going to put up $400 million, half of which would go to rebuilding Haiti's sanitation infrastructure, which is a minimal cost and really very easy to do. Essentially, you're keeping sewage separate from drinking water, which is something which most developed countries have been doing since cholera was discovered back in London in the 19th century. You got to keep those two things apart because that's how the cholera bacteria is transmitted when sewage gets into drinking water. And the second part is to actually give the other 200 million, none of which has been raised yet, by the way, is supposed to go to the families of Haitians who were either sometimes wiped out completely, but many families lost a loved one or had somebody sick for a long time. These would all get some form of compensation for what they endured.
Well, let's back up a little bit and give some context here. How does cholera epidemic spread after the earthquake in 2010?
Well, essentially, the United Nations had been deployed in Haiti since June 2004, after the February 29th coup d'etat against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The U.S., Canada, and France, just as they did back in the in 1994, were the occupiers, the military occupiers of Haiti for the first 3 months. But then they passed off the mission to the UN. And so UN troops had been stationed in the country. It was originally supposed to be an occupation of only 6 months. But here we are going into our 12th year. It was just renewed last week for the 12th time, going on the 13th year. So these UN peacekeepers were deployed around the country, usually different ones in different zones. The Sri Lankans were in Laogan. The Argentinians were around Gonaive. The Peruvians, the Chileans were up in Cape Haitian. But on the Central Plateau, up by the town of Mirabalais, there was a contingent of Nepalese peacekeepers, two forts, if you will, two camps of them. And shortly after the earthquake in January 2010, which was January 12, 2010, some of those peacekeepers went home on leave for a month, I believe it was, and they came back carrying the cholera in their guts, and their outhouses were essentially leaking into the headwaters of Haiti's largest river, the Artibonite. And it began as a few cases. Essentially, it was about a bathtub full of infected water, which was dumped into the headwaters of this river, and it spread from there, and it spread like wildfire across the country, which has already a very compromised sanitation system. And this is not just due to the economic oppression Haiti's endured for the past century, but also from the fact specifically during the coup d'etat against Aristide in 2004, the U.S. stopped funding from the Inter-American Development Bank, about $150 million of funding, which was supposed to go to rebuilding Haiti's sanitation system. So to some extent, the roots, the causes, the context for cholera exploding were set by the U.S. illegal, I should say, intervention with the Inter-American Development Bank in blocking funds to improve Haiti's water system.
We should note that up until that time, Haiti did not have a cholera problem.
Correct. Never has. It has. This is new in Haiti, a new development. Haiti's essentially been, in fact, really destroyed by this, because there is no resistance to cholera. Apparently, in some of the Asian countries where cholera has been endemic, people do develop some resistance, but not in Haiti. So it's torn through the population like wildfire.
So it becomes a pandemic. It spreads like crazy. It's killing people off, more than 10,000 dead. And 7%, according to the report, 7% of the entire population afflicted, infected with the cholera strain, which was early linked to the Nepalese because it was a unique strain of cholera. Now, immediately the UN was put on notice because these are the soldiers that it was supervising, and that should have included care to make sure that sanitation, proper sanitation, was being observed. What happened to these repeated reports that reached Ban Ki-moon and others at the United Nations? Why was there no response?
Well, they were essentially filed in the circular file. There was no the response was essentially to completely ignore them, and it really wasn't until the IGDH and BAI, as I mentioned earlier, brought the suit back in 2012 within the UN's grievance structure. And they essentially sat on it for a year and a half. They made no response. And when they did respond, it was a two-page letter which said, in short, we're immune. Go away. And at that point, they upped the ante, and they went and they found a number of that is, the IJDH and BAI went and found some victims who were living in New York State, and then they sued the UN in the U.S. Courts, the New York courts, and tried to make a class action suit. So far, they've been stymied in large part because the U.S. government has come to the UN's defense. The UN has never even sent its lawyers to defend itself because it says we don't even have to. We're so above the law. We're so immune. We don't even have to respond to those suits. So it's in fact been the U.S. government which has come and argued on their behalf. But as I'm sure your listeners know, Yatrice, the UN is really nothing more than an arm of U.S. foreign policy. It was created essentially to serve UN. U.S. Foreign interests. It's been that way since the Korean War back half a century ago. So now the outcry has been so great and so constant, so persistent, and Ban Ki-moon is going out. He has his legacy to worry about, that they've started to give in, to agree. Even though they haven't agreed that they're legally responsible, they've said, and language means a lot here, they said they're morally, they have a moral responsibility, but they've never uttered the words legal responsibility. And so to some extent, this is the equivalent of a settlement, of a legal settlement where they're giving the money without actually uttering the words, we are legally responsible for what we've done.
In the meantime, this is occurring in the context of this massive 7.0 magnitude earthquake that has leveled so many parts of Haiti. And the Clintons had already swooped in to render, quote, aid, unquote. What was their response to this crisis, this medical crisis?
Well, Bill Clinton, interestingly, did admit as much even about a year before Alston's report. He did admit that the UN had brought in the cholera in a statement that he made. He was still the official UN representative to Ban Ki-moon, or Ban Ki-moon's, I should say, representative to Haiti. So his saying it was important, but it still wasn't the official UN position. But in short, the Clinton State Department and I could say the Obama administration, which is to some extent just an extension of the Clinton machine, has, as I said, been the one defending the UN. They've been the one who have been stonewalling the Haitian people's pursuit of justice in this case. and justice with a dollar sign. That is justice which would include the UN paying for the terrible losses that families have encountered, where some families have been wiped out. I mean, it's a very contagious disease in circumstances of poor sanitation. And this is the minimum that could be done and should be done. Essentially, the Clintons and the Obama administration have until now been deaf and a party to the stonewalling.
But President Clinton at that time had said his priority was to rebuild bigger and better, not just housing, but infrastructure.
Right.
Are you aware of any projects? And here it would seem to be a priority to build or get some kind of a sanitation project going to contain mm-hmm. the spread and to separate, as you correctly said, separate the river water from fecal matter going into it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you
right.
aware of any project at all that addressed the situation? He's there in the middle of it all. Money is rolling in by the billions of dollars. Any project mm-hmm. that suggests that the president of the then the chief administrator, if you will, working under the auspices of the UN, which is being blamed for starting an epidemic that killed 10,000 and infected 7% of the population. Are you aware of any project that addressed the situation?
Not at all. On the contrary, as you say, their slogan was Build Back Better. Nice slogan, but their definition of building back better was to build a luxury hotel with $500 a night rooms. I mean, $500 is more than the yearly income of most Haitians, and building a sweatshop complex in the north of Haiti, about 200 miles from where the earthquake hit up in the Caracol region. And building that sweatshop park was essentially destroying the most valuable farmland in the area, as well as a mangrove forest, as well as a coral reef, as well as a pristine river, and 300 families who were growing food for food insecure Haiti were essentially uprooted. So this is the building back better. And nothing was done for this very sanitation challenge that Haiti faces, which the U.S., under Bill Clinton, in it was not under Bill Clinton, that was under George Bush, but in the lead up to the 2004 coup, essentially the U.S. intervened with the Inter-American Development Bank to block this improvement, the money that had been, in fact, cleared by the IADB to rebuild Haiti's, or help rebuild Haiti's sanitation infrastructure, was stopped. Of course, Bill Clinton could have spoken out about it at the time, could have championed it, but no, this has not been his role. His role has essentially been to give beautiful words. A lot of the time he'll say something, do a mea culpa over the rice he dumped on Haiti in the 1990s, but he, in the end result, always ends up more or less defending the empire.
So with this report, what happens legally now?
So legally, this is the $64,000 question, we could say. The IJDH and BAI, since being essentially shot down by the appeals court earlier this year. The appeals court came back after a hearing last about a year ago. They came back, I believe it was in July or August, it was, and they they said that UN was immune from their suit. Now, the IJDH essentially had, I think it was 3 months to file an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court on this case, and I think they were waiting to see what would happen. So is this new offer of $400 million by the U.N., again, not a penny of which has been actually raised yet, is this new offer a way to sort of offer them bait not to continue their suit, which, by the way, is very taxing, very hard for them to do, perhaps. So will they forge on and continue with the suit and take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, or will they not pursue it and try to go forward with this deal? That's the big question.
Just as a thought, why did the suit specifically target the United Nations and Ban Ki-moon, for example, as UN Secretary General? Why not Bill Clinton as well, since he was officially tasked with seeing to the rebuilding of Haiti?
Right. Well, I guess it, you know, I don't know the legal subtleties of that, but the MINUSTA, the UN, the UN has these different structures. There's the peacekeeping, the UN, there's UNESCO, there's, you know, all sorts of different agencies, which are somehow somewhat independent. And Bill Clinton's office as special representative of the Secretary General is not exactly linked to the MINUSTA, which is, in fact, this military occupation of Haiti. That is carried out through the Office of Peacekeeping, quote-unquote peacekeeping. And again, we should remind the listeners that Haiti is the only country in the Western Hemisphere which has one of these UN peacekeeping missions in it. And in short, is he an accomplice of it? I would say yes, but I guess legally, you know, it may be hard to draw precise legal responsibility to him because MINUSTA is technically a separate agency of the UN.
Thanks a lot, Kim, for being with us today and giving us some insight on this report. And we will continue to monitor it because I think there will be a lot that we should learn about Haiti, not just Haiti in particular, but the process is really very interesting because it raises a question about sovereignty, about who has rights, and in an a situation where you have so much devastation being caused by the introduction of foreign troops into another country, who ultimately is responsible? And right. How do you arrive at a point of compensation? What is proper compensation? So it's a very interesting case. And thanks so much for covering it and being with us today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Utrecht.
Thanks. We'll take this break and come back to complete or continue our discussion from yesterday, right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrecht Lead, and we started talking yesterday about this idea of this election year serving for all of us as a point of reckoning about a whole bunch of things. Our political outlook, our idea of what democracy is, what we want, how should government function, where we are in the scheme of things, do we accept responsibility for the power that we do have? Do we even recognize that we have power? And we should come to terms with some things. And this also applies to the independent parties, the third parties, and I've been very critical of them because I believe that being small is no excuse for failing. And failing to me is repeating the same kinds of mistakes and yet playing by the rules, by their rules, the system's rules, and actually expecting something different to happen from what has been happening repeatedly for many years now. So what is the reckoning? What are we doing? On election day, I should say after election day, the nation will be on a path to a very uncertain future. It does not look good. The immediate future does not look good, I'm telling you. And you get the feeling that we are kind of passive observers of this thing. We're on the train hurtling toward that destination at 100 miles an hour. And we are distracted into discussing things that really aren't that important in the scheme of things. What's important is getting real, arriving at a point of clarity individually and collectively about the system and where we fit and what are we to do for our collective survival, not just for now, but beyond now. We see from these emails that are emerging, we see how completely inept and how base and how inadequate these people are, predatory. They don't have the interests of people at heart. They don't have the interests of the nation at heart. It's just about making money. Making money. It's organized crime. Government itself has abandoned its responsibility to understand that they're elected to see to the interests of the people. That's not their interest at all. They're doing something else. And with the assurance that we could do nothing about it. The sad part of it, and this is the part that concerns me, is that we are playing their game. We're going along with it. And we are distracted into thinking it's about the election. No, it's not about the election. It is about what is the nature of the power equation? What will it be or continue to be if we do not have access to the throttle and brake of government? If we have, in fact, the existence of a renegade government doing whatever it wants to do, certain that the ATM machine, that's us, the people, will just continue funding whatever they want to do. But this entire nation is being ruled by organized political criminals. That's the issue. We have to come to a point of reckoning here, it seems to me. And that includes very close self-examination about our individual power, about the instruments of power that say they represent us, and the obviously crazy mistakes that they're making, blowing it. They've blown it in this election. And we have to let them know that. I mean, how do you get 13 million votes, as Bernie Sanders did get, and hand them over to the Democrats, which was the whole point, was to oppose the Democrats. And then he is able to walk away and still enjoy life as a sycophant of the Democrats. And your 13 million votes, which could easily have been pooled with other political efforts to get some kind of place at the table, abandoned, given away. And we proceed as if, well, you know, it's unfortunate. Something's wrong with us. Something is wrong with us to think that that's okay. Well, anyway, I've talked enough. Queens, Ed, you're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon, Teresa. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm still here. Still here looking at the circus.
As we all are, yeah. What are your thoughts? What is your reckoning? What is the reckoning that you're doing this year?
Well, I mean, as far as for my own personal self, to sort of help the future, I'm involved with an organization that gives seminars and helps teach. Because the biggest problem is, there was an old commercial used to be in New York, SciSim, the educated consumer is our best customer.
Yes.
People don't understand the basic mechanics of government. I mean, at one of the seminars, I asked a question to 20-somethings to 30-somethings. How does a bill, how do you make a law in this country? I mean, just the mechanics of it. And you'd be surprised. 9 out of 10 people didn't even know. Some said the president writes it. Some said the Supreme Court. So until we you can only destroy a thing, which this system needs to be destroyed.
I have news for you, Ed. If you were to ask the average member of the city council and some of the members of Congress, they don't know either.
Well, that's what it has come to. We have accepted mediocrity so much. We have accepted corruption so much that it's not even like you turn a blind eye to it. You expect it. You don't expect these leaders to have any integrity, i.e. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Know what I mean? 20 or 30 years ago, these two wouldn't even thought about running for the presidency of the United States, let alone even dog catcher. So it's just as much their fault as it is our fault. More so our fault, because we turned a blind eye to the process. We turned a blind eye to things like integrity, like loyalty, like fidelity. We turned a blind eye to these things, and now this is what you get. So it's going to be a long process. It's got to be education of the people. It's got to be teaching the people what the mechanics of government is, and then how you can work it to make it work for yourself. And it's going to be a long process. I mean, all we can do right now is educate.
Well, I would agree with you that some things would take time. But for other things, we don't have time. Time has run out. So how do we respond? The same sense of urgency as the problems that demand our attention and our attention immediately. These kinds of problems that we are experiencing, we don't have the luxury of time to wait to see how, you know, we could fix this. We are in a desperate situation. What are we to do?
Well, I mean, we can protest. We can civil disobedience for some of the more major problems, like the environment, like police brutality, like corruption in local government. But the main process is this system needs to be destroyed. It's too corrupt. It's too plagued with money and influence. And until it is destroyed and we come up with something new, because we can only just like try to bandage and fix the holes in the dike. That's all.
Okay. In the situation that we're in, and it's very time sensitive, we're looking at an election in a matter of days. What do you think could be done, even with this awesome challenge before us? What do you think could be done just to begin the process of doing exactly what you say, destroy the system because it's beyond repair?
Well, I mean, other than protest, I don't think there's really anything that would be other than, you know, other than just a gesture to show that we're serious and we're beginning. But, I mean, because you're talking about 20 days out from the election. I think the winner and loser has already been decided. And right now it's just a bunch of trivial garbage that people are discussing. But, you know, I mean, I really don't know. I really don't know if there's anything that can be done that would be beyond gesture, be beyond indication. I don't know.
Well, you're honest about it, and thank you so much for contributing. Thank you, Ed, for your call. 888-874-4888. Look, there is no point in pretending that what we're looking at and what we're experiencing doesn't exist, or it will all blow over and things would be fine. Things will not be fine. Things are about to get exponentially worse. And I'm not just talking about the routine things, about the economy failing, about systems failing. I'm talking about the fact that our ability to correct things also seems to be imperiled because we haven't thought things through either. We have no defense against what we're faced with. And this is the work we have to do internally within our communities to figure out how we can erect some kind of a defense, a credible defense against what's coming, and in fact, what's already here. Mind you, Hillary Clinton, running for president in 2016, that began back in 2000, the year 2000, 2004 for the latest. They don't leave things to chance. The system does not leave things to chance that things accidentally will happen. They plot it. As you can see from these revelations we've been talking about here, they plot their course. And we are just going along with the program, and we lament and we criticize and we complain, but we have no defense. And we have no defense because on our side of the line, our leadership is not doing what it's supposed to do either. And we have given them a lot of leeway to go off course, to do silly and stupid things. That's the issue. The system is behaving exactly according to its plan. Our problem is that we have ineffective systems and very, very ineffective leaders. And we've got to deal with that. I know people are saying, well, what kind of strange tea did you Trace drink this morning? But I've been saying this for a long time. We don't have the luxury of tolerating mediocrity on our side. We don't have that. We don't have the room to take a gradualist approach to anything because we are smack in the middle of a very serious and urgent problem, a series of them. And this is not the time to make stupid mistakes, which were completely avoidable. We will have to wait at least another 4 years, and then they will again put into play the same tired, self-defeating systems that will bring us another wave of losses. So we have to do some reckoning internally. Michael from New Jersey, what are your thoughts?
Hi, Utrecht. I hope you're well. And greetings to the BRN audience. I hope everybody's well. You know, a couple of thoughts that I had. You know, here we are, and like you say, there's very little time. But I always think to myself, the future is now. What I do now is going to determine my future. So, and I think that goes for everybody. I think that's just a law of the universe. What you do now determines your future. It's cause and effect. Now, I think Bernie Sanders did all of us. We've been hoodwinked. I think he really has challenges of his character. I think it's a question of character. I think he's done tremendous damage to progressives and people of goodwill and people that would like to see, you know, a good society, not some kind of conflict or war, but a good society, and that use the right means, etc. I think Bernie Sanders has done an awful, awful thing, and I'm sort of like mimicking what you said, because you said the same thing, but it's dawning on me what a tremendous catastrophe that he has brought about by bringing this whole movement up. And I want to say something. I you know, just months ago when the primaries were taking place in Utah and California thereafter, I read a little article in the New York Times, and I tried to archive it, find it again. I really couldn't. I'm not good at that. I couldn't find it. But it was a funny little article, because it was the oddest thing. It said, you know, as it was getting winding down to the end, and there was that catastrophe in Utah and the travesty in California with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and we didn't even know half of it, which WikiLeaks released later, right? So what it was, the article said that a group of people, I think it seemed to be like from California, were sort of taking over the Bernie Sanders movement. Like, they were sort of looking ahead past this whole thing, and they saw what was happening, and they were going to continue the movement. And they said that they first had to defeat Donald Trump, and then they were going to move the... And then Bernie came out. In the same article, Bernie came out and was furious about he didn't know these people, and he had nothing to do with them, and they you know, they're completely, you know, not. And it didn't give who the people were. It was an odd little article, and I remember it because of its oddity, because everybody was anonymous. But that group somehow was shot down, and at first I you know, at that time I was still rooting for Bernie. And I said, my God, Bernie's right. Who are these people? Who are they to take over? And then I've changed my view of the whole thing, because Bernie, it turns out, had no character at all in this. He completely capitulated, collapsed, and he's done tremendous damage to a tremendous movement that was building. There could have been, and I don't know, it's a great frustration, it's past, right? So what
well,
do
I'm
we
gonna,
do now?
I'm going to say something a little different in response to your offering here. It is not even about Bernie Sanders. Because you may recall from very, very early on, I said, you got to watch this guy.
Yes, you
and
did. I remember.
I did a program that said, the people of this movement have to prepare for betrayal. I said that.
Oh, I'm sorry, my dog.
It was so clear that it was coming. This was it, my point is, and I really don't want to sound like I'm beating people up, but I am frustrated that people are just not putting together, scientifically putting together this issue, this thing called movement building. I saw it, and it's not because I'm so brilliant. It is because I pay attention to history. You pay attention, and you see what is likely to happen. So nothing becomes a surprise. They didn't have to go to some, you know, psychic somewhere in the deep Himalayas or anything to figure that out. You just had to look carefully at developments and refer to history. And you know that more than likely, this is going to be part of your challenge to face down the possible betrayal of the person that you handed the power to. But it is also disturbing that even after he did that, they did nothing. Everybody just backed off and literally allowed him to give away 13 million votes that they worked so hard to generate. And they allowed him to do it. It's not that Bernie Sanders is so powerful. It is that the people are so powerless. And that's the choice that they're making. They make the choice to be powerless. What did I say? You're supposed to fire the man. Make a big thing about it. And take back your revolution. It does not belong to him. It's not his personal property. But they let these 13 million votes go. Now, why is this so infuriating? Hillary Clinton knows that she's in trouble. She's known it for a long time. The only salvation she has is mining the black vote, and now she's working hard at the Latino vote as well. She's worked to cultivate the white female vote, but that is a notoriously skittish vote. Unpredictable. She needs solid people, and she needs solid votes. She doesn't need to have any questions about loyalty. That's the history of politics, especially as it applies to African Americans and Latinos. So she's looking to build a solid base there. She doesn't have it, but she's working hard at it. But compared to any other voting constituency, African Americans and Latinos would be perhaps the most loyal and most predictable. Okay. Now, imagine, just as a tactical thing, you have 13 million votes. Bernie Sanders has 13 million votes. Hillary Clinton's survival this time around hinges on those 13 million votes. She doesn't have all these other votes in hand. Everybody's very, very upset about, are they going to come through? Especially in light of these stories that keep unfolding about the Clintons' criminal enterprise called the Foundation. But 13 million votes are a sure bet. If she gets even half of those, if half of those turn out, she's in good shape to win. And who's offering it? Bernie Sanders. These are not his votes. Now, what would have happened if people did the right thing, the smart thing, the sensible thing at the time that it happened, immediately? You nullify those votes. You work on nullifying those votes so that people will not willingly follow the leader's advice that they should vote for Hillary Clinton. And you take those votes and you call a meeting and you discuss a pragmatic thing to do. Because if you add your 13 million votes, you add that to, let's say, the Green Party's votes, you add that to the Libertarian Party's votes, you add it to other small parties, that aren't going to get a lot of votes, but they'll have votes. And you come together to say, we are, for this cycle, we are making the statement that we are opposing this corrupt system. We oppose it. And we encourage people to vote for a different kind of government. Come November, election day, vote for whoever you want. But we are gathered as a group. We all share a distaste for what we are seeing, and we object to it. Now, you would have turned the whole thing completely on its head, and you would have seized back your power. But we had people just walk away. I don't understand it. And so we now have to question, what is the leadership vision here? What is the leadership vision among the progressive community or the third parties? What is your vision? This election will go, and we will have achieved nothing. And so now the reckoning has to be, and we have to have a brutally honest conversation. Is it okay for a party simply because it says we are for the people and we are progressive? Is it okay to make stupid mistakes time after time? No, it's not. And if it is going to continue making stupid mistakes, then don't look to me for support. I don't like the idea of repeated failures that don't have to be. That's where I am. I think we have to get to these parties and really have a come to Jesus meeting. Because you can't tell me that it's okay to blow 20, 25 years and we can't get off the block, the starting block. No, something is wrong. And somebody has to explain how they're going to fix it. Thank you for joining me today. We are going to, of course, have our Free Your Mind Friday session tomorrow, so we'll continue the conversation. It should be continued. We have to have a reckoning, and it requires us squarely facing the problem, not with the aim of destroying anybody or destroying anything, but making it clear that we do not have the luxury of making repeated mistakes. We do not have the ability to bounce back. We're all getting older and, you know, getting grizzly. And we, too, have a responsibility to demonstrate our leadership in the things that we say we want to get accomplished in the interest of the people. See you tomorrow. Stay tuned. Expanding Mind with Eric Davis is coming up. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.